see if there's a
are we there? We're there. I think we're ready.
Okay.
So if you want to jump in.
No, I don't. Maybe I would start with questions related to how you locate yourself in contemporary culture, in contemporary architectural culture. Basically tracing back your relationship to can you have that?
Have a copy of that?
Yeah. Basically how you relate yourself to both previous generations and visions of future generations that you think your work will inspire or is opening up the paths for. Yeah, I mean concretely with who do you affiliate your work with, and with how would you expect your work to evolve through other people?
Well, one thing that's been important to us as we've been developing our practice, still relatively young practice, and that we think is a little bit in the spirit of our generation, is kind of collaborative, open source, in some ways do-it-yourself approach to research and design and our own work and teaching and practice. And I think that's kind of part of our generation. In other words, the idea that we can in some ways have a startup mentality, and that we can kind of make something happen, both in the spirit of open source software, so that, software as a culture of like making a startup company, but also in the spirit of kind of collaborating in fields beyond architecture, leaving a trace of what our research is so others can build off of it in the future, similarly building off of the work of other people in the past. And that maybe is related to technologies that are making that more possible now to kind of share material, including things like instructions of how we were able to in the future, and building off of and it's not actually a totally new approach, but it seems like a lot of the people that we consider in the field of architecture share something of that spirit. It also, I think, has roots in, like, music, for example. We've admired some things about the band Fugazi and their whole kind of mentality of both a kind of startup idea, the idea of making their music available to other people in a cheap, kind of open way, kind of non-exclusive mentality.
Mm-hmm. So would you say, I mean, actually my question was in a way trying to request for a sort of historicity of the work in cultural terms.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way your answer, if I'm not wrong, the way I understand it, in a way avoids that in the sense of how would you say that it avoids that? I mean, in the sense of being understanding your work as a material that is kind of taken from other sources and then developing it and then proposing itself as open to keep to continue that development by others, as if it was a sort of technological evolution to a certain extent, rather than a sort of would say culturally it responds to a context, to a cultural context, basically. As if the progression would be a sort of linear progression, or of course with variations and with variations, but as if you understand your work as part of a linear progressive development. Is that right? Instead of a critical development.
Well, I don't know. It's a good point to a diagram there.
Yeah. I think in a way we often, I don't know how this will happen in the interview actually, but we often describe our work with this diagram and even continuously developing it to include more contents. Grow this diagram both as a kind of a conceptual understanding of how we work and how we position ourselves within the larger kind of body of work that came potentially from before us, and also that would happen after us with kind of, it's more like with the help of what we do in a way. So for example, in the class that we teach, we make sure that, let's say the class starts from something that we initiated at a certain point, but the class actually explores multiple outcomes from that same point rather than directing all the students to a particular agenda, let's say. And I think we're really interested in that, and potentially also all of those multiple agendas and specific techniques involved in developing those being shared with the students and with the larger community of designers and architects and thinkers for it to kind of evolve or kind of mutate into something else. So I guess in a way, I don't know if we are avoiding to place ourselves in a certain lineage.
Well, I think it's good to re-ask that, but I think partly we think of the idea of collaboration in this diagram as being a kind of cultural response. So it's not only a technique in order to get more and more efficient circuits or faster work processes or whatever. But I think that is part of our response to our cultural moment. Mm-hmm. I mean, meaning, so it's a little bit maybe a response, as has often occurred in the history of architecture or art or anything. It's somewhat a response to approaches that have occurred before, but it's maybe what we're saying is that's our approach that is responding to other approaches rather than our content responding to other content.
Mm-hmm. Like, for example, to give a
I think in our early work, a lot of what we were interested in doing was saying, what can we develop as a component of a building that can be deliberately understood to be in the context of other components, that can be kind of scalable, swappable, that's more modular, that is designed deliberately to have connections. And that approach is, I think, partly in contrast to and in response to the idea that the only thing that's architecture is a new building that creates the entire environment kind of by itself, of course responding to site and context, but that it's more of that flavor of understanding these loops, on multiple scales and in multiple ways, like between our own ideas, but also to other people, to other buildings, one component of a building to other components.
Mm-hmm. And I think that attitude is very much influenced by things like open source movement or Wikipedia, things like that, where people, including, let's say in our context, including us and our students or our fellow designers or teachers, all kind of collaborating and developing something together rather than us having the burden of having to design or develop something that's so complete in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to play that up in one more way, something like Wikipedia, it's hard to say who is the author. We think that's interesting. It's also a kind of cultural moment and technological moment. And I think just we've been naturally drawn to that kind of approach and influenced by that kind of approach and are applying that in some ways to design and architecture. So I think in that way you can compare that to past approaches, which would be very clear who the author of a building is, who the architect of a building is. And we're kind of exploring a slightly different approach to that.
Yeah. So would you say that your work is possible due to certain technologies or devices or means of communication or media that are happening or have been kind of developed in the last 10 or 15 years? Or would you say that your work has something maybe more atemporal or sort of that maybe has versions? There are versions of your project as a practice that can be traced back to moments in the history of architecture where those media and those phenomena were not present.
Well, certainly part of what makes it possible to use our approach and to operate in the way we do involves some technologies. I mean, the idea that we can know about in a very kind of quick and seamless time cycle the work of others who are exploring something similar would be very different than past moments in history. I'm kind of thinking about scientific explorations now where independently maybe two people would be working on inventing a light bulb or something, and they would not know about each other's research. There would be the potential of that. And we think now that's, you know, we're at a different moment in media and communication where that's no longer true. But similarly, you know, if we think about the history of inventions, I think there's always been this idea that, or the possibility that people are influenced by many things in their cultural and technological context, and that's why people tend to come up with inventions independently at the same time. So I'm not sure if that gets directly.
Actually, partially yes. Only that I'm trying to trace back into the history of architecture, not into the history of science.
Sure.
Your work. Mm-hmm. So my questions in a way are more oriented towards understanding if you find that the form of practice that you are developing, maybe with other people as well in the field and so on, architecture has historical precedence within the history of architecture as a form of practice, or if you acknowledge that, like, I don't know, Archiram or something, that in which maybe technologies were completely different, but the attitude maybe could be understood as similar, or for example, I mean, but I'd
yeah.
like to hear that from you also, because
sure.
Yeah, I think one precedent that we, I think, both like, I like them at least a lot, I think we both like them, are the Eameses, I think, because they work with a really wide variety of medium, with the notion of the design as a very kind of broad and cultural thing, and their work was always culturally relevant and intelligent. So I think if we had to kind of trace back in history and kind of find somebody that we admire or like the work of, I think the Institute might be one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and certainly there are things about, say, Archigram that we admire very much, and that spirit of a kind of collective coming together, kind of looking at everything from a fresh perspective, or at least thinking kind of in that way, which we think the Eameses share as well. in some ways, Buckminster Fuller is an interesting example in his spirit of kind of inventiveness and small thinking and tinkering that has huge implications. So it's kind of thinking at these multiple scales at once. Although, you know, as we're drawing on references from these people in the past, like someone like Fuller, we may not draw as much from him on a kind of collaborative approach, but something about his approach to design and problem solving has been interesting to us.
So how would you say would be the way or the move in which your practice operates are different or similar to the way and mode that those practices were working? Let's say, if some of these practices were relating technology to the sort of core of the discipline with a certain attitude, like, I don't know, humor, irony, cynicism, megalomania, sophistication, domestication. What would you say is the attitude that your practice has towards technology and the way it is appropriated?
That's another very good question. But I think our attitude in general is kind of earnest rather than ironic. Optimistic. And so...
And also humanist, I think, definitely, to put... I mean, not to be... I'm sorry, I cut you off. But
no, go ahead.
I don't think we kind of... We had kind of an interesting conversation in a similar context with Halder Jung the other day also. But what I also really liked about their attitude, which I think we share, is that rather than being obsessive about the technology or the technique itself, I think we are also interested in what it produces and what it can actually offer back to our society and culture to make it more interesting and more rich, and how that benefits people and their lives.
But another important aspect in our attitude toward technology might be summarized by the idea of testing. So we're interested in our own work in creating prototypes, in taking an idea or a question and building something, often full scale, often a functioning prototype that can test that idea. And that might be a slightly different attitude than some other current approaches, but also prior approaches. So, and that can a little bit be summarized by our a method that we've developed for ourselves in some ways out of necessity, but we started to like this way of operating. We call it flash research. So we just kind of invented some constraints for ourselves in researching new questions or problems, and we said a flash research project has to have a limited budget, $1,000 or less in supplies, a limited time frame, 3 months or less, and the third component is to have to develop a testable, full-scale, functioning prototype in order to explore possibilities. So that research method is, in some ways, encapsulates our approach toward technology. That we, you know, that might be in contrast to knowing that biologists, synthetic biologists, are genetically engineering seeds so that they might eventually grow into a tree that's occupiable. So you can basically genetically engineer a house. Knowing about that is very interesting to us, but since we can't get our hands on that technology, since we can't test it, since we can't learn from the results of having kind of cobbled together a prototype out of it. That's not something that we would forefront as one of our research opportunities. And that might be different than some other approaches in the past, where they take more kind of pleasure in and liberties with imagining a future that we can't yet touch.
Mm-hmm. So in a way you have a commitment with the sort of doability and accessibility of the technique and the technology, and the sort of if I'm not wrong, sort of ethics of do it yourself. I mean, in a way that can be traced into many other projects, or even the way you show them, no? Like the idea of manual in this book, for example, or information you display on the website, there is at least the representation, the display of instructions of how to do things. Do you feel there is a responsibility from your practice, from our side, to make some of the technologies not only appropriated by architects for design purposes, but also communicatable to regular people that maybe are not architects?
I think that's a great that is part of our representation of projects, to say it's as important to publish our instructions or circuit diagrams or technical specifications as it is to show a glossy photograph or rendering. Mm-hmm. And that is a kind of ideological choice. So in other words, it supports the idea that one loop of research might lead to 100 other possible projects. And we like the idea that our project would be aware of that and leave links so that others can explore. And likewise, we would done in the past, I guess we said that a little bit already.
Future and kind of demystify it in a way so that, and that helps get people involved now. More people know about it, there's more participation probably.
Yeah, so we definitely like the idea that our own work would be accessible, and the instruction would be accessible to non-architects or non-specialists. And that relates to a kind of bigger agenda that even our own approach to architecture tries to draw on a slightly outsider approach or non-expert approach, and we like the idea that often someone coming fresh to a problem, and probably a lot of architects share this idea that architects are problem solvers, even if they don't know about hospitals or traffic patterns in a certain city, an architect can be a problem solver, hear all of the information that they have. Share that and try to keep ourselves in some ways as non-experts, and love the idea that our research would then be accessible to all kinds of non-experts as well.
So, just to clarify that point, and maybe with a position, black and white thing, would you see yourself as non-architects or as architects that make a certain field of expertise, whatever that is, or whatever you decide it is, to non-architects? I mean, would you see yourselves as architects that are being paternalistic towards the non-experts, or would you see yourself as a model of non-experts? If you let me do the black and white question, you can also...
I mean, think we certainly think of ourselves as architects, and that's important to our approach and our work.
Sometimes I ask my students that, you know, if your project is good and it's very clear, then you should be able to explain it to your mom, and your mom would get it. And I think even if you are very much architects, the building, let's say we build a building, we're not going to be there to explain it to people probably. And so ultimately, even if we are architects, I think the work, having the quality to be able to like be read very easily and to be shared very easily by a lot of people, I think is a very important thing for us.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. But I also want to add that I guess I'm not sure that's a super important distinction for our own work with architects versus non-architects. And so I guess we don't often think about that boundary. We kind of just operate on issues, problems, questions, even commissions in a way that, like, I think gives us more freedom. And so if we have to stop and think about it, which I think is a great thing sometimes, then we would say, actually, the kind of practice that we like, even if it's a design practice, really wants to engage with artists, or really wants to have some of the qualities of people who are developing mobile phone technologies. So let's just do it. Let's not consider that we might have to stop our research or our, you know, the boundaries of our project at some point because of our official training.
Why do you do that? As an architect. Or why would you say that other people should do that in contemporary architecture?
Well, why we do it is maybe our interests. I don't know. Do you think that's reasonable?
Yeah, I think so. I think.
That's why I asked the second part.
I mean, well,
would you promote this kind of practice as a sort of, aside your personal interests, which are clear through the work, would you promote this kind of practice as a model of practice that is relevant to contemporary culture? What would be the reason for that?
I mean, I think in general, yes, or we would venture to explore, you know, what would happen if everyone operated in this way, or, you know, if some people operated in this way. And I don't know, maybe an example of that. Well, so I think it's possible that is necessary to engage new complexities of the world. Or maybe there have always been these complexities, but in our current world there's a lot of complexities, and therefore the question to me should not be why go outside the field, but it should more be like why talk about the field? You know, to kind of reverse it. And so one example of that, I guess, is that things like sensor technologies or mobile phone technologies could potentially be considered to be outside of the field of architecture. But really, they're so potentially important to the way we engage the world, the way we operate in space, that it doesn't make sense to us to exclude that from our mode of operation. So it's interesting to think about what if the architecture could text message you, what if you could text message the architecture. Similar with sensors, that although those in some ways are the expertise of chemical engineers or electrical engineers, what if we, you know, how might that change our world if we were able to have new ways of interfacing with that information? And so the boundary, the idea that there would be something beyond our ability to kind of question and even tinker with is...
Yeah. And in a way, the reason why I'm asking these kind of questions is because it's what one could say that sensor technology is a technology that is traditionally outside architecture and that is being used by other fields and not by architects, and then what if we use it? But there is also another way of looking at it, which is that this technology has been used already in the field of architecture, concretely in the last 10 years or 15 years, there has been and also before, but let's say particularly in the last 10 or 15 years, there is a form of history of the use of sensor technology in architecture.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's why I'm trying to historize the work, because because now it's about a mode of doing that and not the fact that you do that. And in that sense, for example, one of the issues that I saw in some of the work was a certain preoccupation with sensation, like the glow, the river glow project, or the amphibious architecture project, have a certain commitment to producing some form of sensation by expressing conditions that are happening under the water or in the water itself. No? So my question there would be, what form of sensation you are interested in? What particular forms of sensation, and if I can rephrase myself, what kind of humor, what kind of mood, or what kind of form of experience that sensation is incarnating, and why maybe?
I think that's a good reading. I mean, we're certainly interested in atmospheres and producing and influencing atmospheres as a way of engaging space and architecture. As far as how we might describe those sensations, although, I think we're interested in a variety of ways in which one could produce sensations like that, but we're also aware that there are, to rephrase it, I think we're interested in exploring, and several of our projects have explored, giving meaning to sensations, having sensations be an interface to something. And one thing that we've been exploring in a more targeted way is the use of sensation in a current project in Seoul, Korea, where it's a context where there is a lot of sensation. If we can describe colored LEDs on the facades of buildings to be producing a sensation, that's a certain trend in the city. Mm-hmm. And we're interested in participating in that discussion. What if buildings can produce sensation through their facades? But adding to that discussion, what if that sensation had a very relevant meaning? So rather than some buildings in the city producing a variety of effects that could be understood generally as pattern making, mood making, we're interested in making some of those same effects or similar effects, but with a very specific meaning about, say, air quality in one neighborhood compared to another, or in one neighborhood today compared to that neighborhood a year ago today.
To make visible things that are otherwise invisible through the sensation that you create. One kind of interesting example in the city of Seoul, because the Living Light project is in Seoul, is the facade of the Galleria department store by UN Studio, which is a huge kind of LED facade that creates certain mood, but
the one with the case.
Yeah. So I mean, it's really beautiful and it creates certain kind of artistic mood. And I think for our project, I think that's great, but it's already been done. So can you do something slightly different or something more by using these kind of sensation or mood, let's say, that's been created? Can you also communicate a information or data that's meaningful to the life of the citizens? And I think we're definitely interested in that.
And in that particular project, something that we're exploring that's a kind of additional feature to some of the other prior projects like River Glow. So in addition to exposing something about environmental information, a condition that's normally invisible, in Living Light, we're interested in creating an interface not only to data about air quality, but to public interest in air quality or public interest in the environment. So to say, we're not only going to use this sensation to show you something about the environment, something, you know, maybe somewhat natural, but we're going to use this interface to show you something about the social. So specifically how we do that is to allow people to send a text message to our building facade. They get a text message back with the local air quality of a neighborhood. But more importantly, on the facade itself, it registers that someone is interested in something somewhere.
And that your neighborhood.
Yeah, so they're interested in the air quality in the neighborhood. And that register is interesting to us too, given the fact that people are doing a lot of things with data these days, and there's a lot of personalization of data. How can we somehow aggregate that and offer that as an information bank?
So in a way, you're interested in the relationship between some form of meaning, which you associate to an event or a phenomenon, being a social phenomenon or a natural phenomenon, or some kind of condition that is triggering a certain effect that you incarnate through a sort of field of expression, and your architecture is the decision or the selection of what phenomena with what forms of expression and the means of communication, basically. But how about the expression itself, not only in relation to the content or to the phenomenon, but in relation to how these things are expressed, and how is that expression different as an aesthetic mechanism, or as an aesthetic effect, or as a political effect, or as a shock to other forms of expression, beyond the fact that it communicates something happening, but rather in itself, as a form of experience. Like, basically, if one talks about soul, I understand the difference between sort of the advertisement strategies or the sort of intense expression of buildings during the night, etc., existing there, and the form that you're proposing, which would be communicating some event concretely. But as a form of expression itself, how would it be different to the forms of expression existing in the city, aesthetically? Or it wouldn't be. It would be a way of organizing those forms of expression and give them meaning, basically.
I think to a certain degree, I don't think you can only talk about the expression without the content, or one shouldn't. Because the content being associated with it, I think, changes the meaning of it in a very important way.
So how would you say that it changes? I mean,
we've made, like in this exact project of Living Light, we've made a series of decisions about the phenomenon or the expression based on communicating information. So it's not that we independently developed the the sensation part and then decided how to make use of it, is that it was very integral to the concept that it's just gotten. But to answer, I don't know, and it's what I think is a slightly different way to answer the question. We, in contrast to a billboard that does display advertising or that has the capacity to display advertising, we're more interested in sensation or effects that kind of change, well, that change the mood potentially or the atmosphere of the space. So, I mean, certainly a digital billboard, which is displaying like a Times Square, New York Times Square billboard, can kind of change the mood. But I think we're interested in types of sensations and effects that might, in some general way, share the same thing, same purpose as the content. So in other words, some of the effects that we're naturally drawn to might cause one to stop in one's tracks, not out of a jolt of shock, but out of a somewhat otherworldly sensation or experience. And as far as an aesthetic of sensation, that's interesting to us. Just like, and the reason I say it's maybe similar to the approach of content is that we might want to expose people to content or offer up content that would also offer one to, in some way, stop in their tracks, think about the world afresh, reimagine possibilities, give a moment of pause in a busy day or life. And, you know, it's a very general description, but I think that is a thing that we sometimes talk about in calibrating that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was actually going to ask about that, and what you already asked, but maybe I ask it again. To have certain forms of experience to make them more aware about certain things happening. Anyway, would you say that you work for people like that? Would that be your...
Yeah, I mean, in some
what way. Do you work for?
I think as Suen was mentioning before, there is a certain sense that we have that our projects have to serve some kind of public. You know, they're responsible to the public, they're responsible to the world. So in some ways we work for the public. That sounds a little funny.
Yeah,
but
no, I mean, what form of public I would ask? Like, in a way, the cities that you talk about, I mean, I'm from Buenos Aires. Maybe Buenos Aires is a big city and so on, but in a way, it doesn't have certain excessive logics like other cities, like in Asia or even in the States, where certain forms of expression are already taking over the experience of the city, and one can talk about the certain user, which is the consumer, basically. And it's, I mean, for example, one hypothesis I would make is that you work for consumers, not for people in general, but for a certain type of people that is the consumer of late capitalism or in highly developed countries. But maybe I'm wrong. That's what I'm trying to get from you. Perhaps I want to know the responsibility that you are taking on board in your work, more broadly, but more specifically from the perspective of the work itself. No?
For until now, I think, like David said before, our projects were or are in the public realm, so hence we work for the public. I don't think we would be opposed to working for a different audience, like a very private client or whatnot. But I think one thing that we kind of share is, I don't know if this is like too traditional or not, but one thing that I think we share is some kind of a responsibility back to culture and society, and to produce something that's meaningful and that could be helpful to people, like help people imagine something different or provide something that they haven't seen or otherwise wouldn't see, or to create some kind of like to feel the responsibility to be valuable to our society and culture, I think is something that we probably share. And in a larger sense, that could be our client. I mean, even if we produce a building that's for a private client, still, I think there should be a level of engagement where it produces at the same time something that's valuable for either a culture of architecture or just general culture or society or something beyond.
Well, and one example, I mean, I guess it seems important to mention at least one project that doesn't have technology and sensors in the way we've been describing it. I don't know. I want to get back to the issue of consumer in a minute. But, we're doing a project now that is basically building an artist studio in upstate New York. So it's for a private client. It has no sensors or network technologies involved. But it is exploring something that may relate back to a responsibility toward a broader audience than the private client and toward a version of the public. Mm-hmm. So it's basically an artist studio that we have conceptualized and designed to be made out of 90% or so salvaged materials. And we call it the House of Doors because it's literally a small house made out of mainly just doors, and these doors are salvaged, would have otherwise been discarded. And there is, I mean, this can now maybe be taken for granted in the way that digital technologies, like using the computer to 3D model, can be taken for granted, but we do feel a responsibility toward the environment, I guess, most generally, because that's, and potentially, you know, in a kind of cliche way, because that's our shared resource, because that's a public resource. And so in that project, we have tried to respond to the client's needs, but also show some responsibility to a larger world, if not audience, because whether or not people see or understand what we've done, it was important to us to in this project, explore a kind of minimal footprint on the environment by using salvage materials and responding to ideas such as the fact that 30% of landfills are construction waste, that the construction of a typical home, at least in the United States, generates 8,000 pounds of waste. So it's a slightly different way of getting at your question. But the consumer thing and the capitalism thing, I don't know, that's a good question, and I'm not sure we are directly engaging that. I mean, it's important for us to not only have work that's accessible to a small percentage of the population, but it's also now true that even in developing countries, many people use cell phones. So the idea that technology equals elite and equals consumer, I guess we don't totally think of it that way. Mm-hmm.
So the idea pauses me, you're going to ask yet another hard question.
Yeah, your questions are too difficult.
I
just want to get as far as possible. Maybe like I can be more entertaining. No. I want to get as far as possible. I don't know. Okay. It's some of the things I've never thought about or about that.
Well, it's good. It's what a good interview should be. It's like to challenge one to look and think, and you as the interviewer are challenging us to think about our own work in any way.
I mean, actually, currently, and I don't know if this is part or not of the interview, but I'm interested, in a way, from the first question, also to know where you're going. Like, what do you have in mind? What is the sort of cultural challenge you have? What is it that you're aiming to do? Through the work that you're doing, what in a way inspires or sort of gives meaning to the work, aside of course its particularities and its general sessions or sort of exploration, no? But what is the work being the means for? And that's what I'm looking for. And in a way, actually, while some of the projects, like the Living City, the Living Light, the River Glow, and the Living Glass, establish a relationship, or let's say, the Living City, all of them, establish a relationship between the content and the form of expression, and in a way the project is about that mediation. But then the content changes. Sometimes it's about the activities in the city, sometimes it's about the sort of behavior of fishes, sometimes it's about the conditions in the environment, and so on. While the forms of expression tend to be more or less similar, having to do with light, for example, rather than, I don't know, in that sense, for example, living is a little bit different because it's more like a material transformation rather than a light effect. But let's say there is a sort of a certain homogeneity in the form of expression and the variation in the content. In this project that you're mentioning, which is House of Doors, the content clearly relates to some other projects, no? Like to the in a way, because for example of a certain responsibility towards the environment and so on, you can relate it at the level of content with the River Glow project or. In a way, now we are shifting the conversation to a question of a concern about some forms of content in which you are, in a way, interested in at least expressing that there is a problem, if not solving the problem or helping solving the problem. So I'm trying to locate your focus basically in that, no? And perhaps it's something that you are, in a way, extending at the moment your field rather than focusing. That seems maybe my questions are unfair, but I just want to know where you're located, more or less at the moment, where your heart is located.
Your heart
is located as a form of as a search. That's my question, who you're working for. Basically, not that literally what kind of people, but what's your ambition, basically, like in the sense of what are the forces that you are trying to kind of direct or resist through your work?
I think there are. They're kind of multiple questions within that, potentially multiple ways we could respond to them. I think one is that, yes, there's something about ecology and environment that's a theme in some of the content of our work, right? In the content of several projects, especially when you look at them together.
and that's certainly on our minds. And frankly, I think it would be crazy of anyone for it to not be on their mind.
And potentially foolish
of our culture and society to not treat that with the utmost urgency. But as far as a kind of longer term vision for responsibility, or to kind of rephrase your question, like, what is our work in service of? I don't think that will necessarily. I think that is subject to change as the technologies. That's one way to put it. Because I think that, you know, while this, you know, again, just like this again, if for one, it's not totally linear, but there's certain ways. I think that things like sensor technologies will change, but so will other conditions of our world, and so say in 20 years, what's probably going to be, you know, to venture to say what would be most constant in our work, or most still the same about our work, would be that would be more this, just the blank diagram of this, that we would consider it our work to be related to work by others, content by others, and in the general world and culture in general, and technologies that others are developing, and technologies in the general world. And so this ecosystem approach of our work in relation to other work and to our world, and the way of understanding a single project to have to engage and hook into a lot of things, I think, I'm guessing would remain somewhat the same, but I think the content and the technology might change drastically. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I think it kind of comes from what David said before, of us in a way believing that oftentimes outsiders can bring in more fresh perspective to certain problems, and they can provide more interesting solutions because they don't know too much about the inner workings of a certain thing. And because of that, I think we're interested in and kind of willing to take on different challenges, and we actually enjoy them. Like the House of Doors, I think we want it to be as, I mean, we could have been, you know, involved a sensor or whatnot in the project, let's say, for example. But even so, we, I guess, at a certain point want to take on a different kind of challenge, different kind of communication or aesthetics or whatnot, and see if we can work within that. I think that's always interesting.
Maybe there's an easy way. The third question here, which is, just to, in this context, what do you think is the most significant project? Like the project that tells you where you're going, or what you have done? I don't know. I mean, it's a very interactive question, but maybe.
Well, one way of answering is that what's been on our mind a lot is actually just solving all of the logistical challenges to get living a life. So,
is that happening?
And yes, it's happening. We're under contract to make that happen. But yeah, we're having some issues with actually the legal contract between the city agency that has commissioned it and the property owner who's going to host it. And so that's involved us with a whole new level of logistical challenges in some ways, just because there are multiple stakeholders and clients. So while there are a lot of challenges to a House of Doors, there's really just one client, which is the owner of the property. And I'm mentioning that because I think it's maybe relevant to what we think is one of the reasons we think Living Light is significant as well as challenging, is that it has multiple stakeholders. that it has a wide audience. It's going to be in a public space. And so as far as a way to measure both significance but also challenges, I think that's one that's on our mind a lot. That bringing this, it's also bringing a level of prototype experimentation for several years to a level of robustness and scale, both in terms of how big the pavilion is, but also how many people use it and interact with it. Is one way to measure the, you know, the significance.
It's also challenging because I think a lot of the things that we do by nature is things that haven't been done exactly that way before. And even for Living Light Project, the call for entry wanted a different perspective or different approach to public art, but the actual bureaucracy or the system is not flexible enough to allow for things that haven't been done before to actually happen. And I think even for House of Doors, it's similarly true that if that exact thing hasn't been tried and done before, then it's really kind of difficult to convince people.
I kind of just want to jump in real quick, because I think there's a lot of strength here, and I'm curious because I'm curious of your part of your process and what you just described as a kind of as your method of research, all the complexities that come together. I'm curious as how that relates to your process, because it seems to me, at least in some part, what you've made very present is in some ways what part of what architecture has always had in some way, right? But that you're bringing it to the forefront. That, you know, there's a lot of the question and debate when we were discussing the questions, and of particular interest to me is the idea of research, right? That that's something that seems incredibly present amongst the group of people that were chosen, you know, just in practice today, and that you guys in particular really kind of forefront that. I think it has strands that relates to this idea of consumerism, that you're willing to kind of put it all out there and say, this is how we did it, this was the process, these are the inner workings, and it relates to that idea of the idea of complexity. And I wonder if you could just speak to that about research just a tiny bit, but also I actually think it relates to the idea of consumerism, that architecture in each condition has a kind of unique quality, that it's not something that's ever kind of reproduced, and that it's always a constant kind of research project.
Yeah.
And I just find it intriguing that you forefront that as opposed to the kind of end product.
Well, that's interesting. And so one way to look at it is if all of architecture now and in history has been one-off, like it's just about a unique response to a unique situation. It's not a you know, and every new project and situation requires a new analysis, and every building at some moment of time has never been done at that exact moment of time in that exact place before. So it's an insane there always has to be something new and unproven and untested about a project. And I think, yeah, we do kind of see it that way, that what we're doing is not entirely different than that line of thinking that's always existed. So every architecture project is always kind of a research project. I guess more specifically, we're just interested in kind of amping that up to say, like, how many untested things can we explore in this project, and pushing that, you know, as high as possible.
And maybe because of the kind of collaborative nature of our process, or the open source kind of sharing is more important, because if everybody's doing things that are unproven, then the more we share, the more grounds there is for, like, something that we've done to cover somebody else's work, you know, something that somebody else is working on currently. And also because it's always unique, it's not like by not sharing, we'll patent and make more money or something. It's sort of, and you know, the thing is out there, the building is out there anyways. So
yeah. But I guess and sharing our process is kind of in service of the most aggregate exploration of our whole field.
Yeah.
You know, so like there's so many things that are untested and unproven. Why not share, like, in our small way, what we're testing and trying to prove, so that others can not have to do that again, or they would redo it differently but deliberately understanding. And we would, you know, kind of advocate a world where everyone does that, so it's a reciprocal relationship. And so that is probably part of our motivation toward exposing the process. Like, let's test new things and let's everyone, you know, kind of contribute to an ecosystem of research where we can all just explore more total ground.
What kind of things would you take from one project to another, or from one, the particularities of one research to the next? Do you take literally sorts of technology? Do you take literally ways of scripting things? Do you take literally, I don't know, forms of effects?
I probably all of the above, or at least we would put that all on the table at the beginning. So we would say, you know, what do we already have some prototype for, and can we use that or not? Do we have to, so in some ways, even though every project's a one-off, we don't start totally anew any time.
Yeah,
we say what's already been done.
Yeah,
but from our own stuff, but also from other people. So can we get something off the shelf that does everything we need? Because there's no need for us to reinvent something if it's already being done well. We do interrogate. If we get it off the shelf, is it being, are all the decisions in that exact implementation what we want to be doing and saying? But if the answer is yes, then we don't need to build for ourselves. We'll use that off the shelf and build from there.
And also I think there's a kind of a desire for us to develop things, like David mentioned before, in a modular way, one, or things as platforms, so that platform can accommodate a lot of different conditions. For example, we are including text messaging interface to the Living Light project in Seoul. And this semester at school, the interactive kind of responsive kinetic architecture class that we teach also involve research into text messaging. So that knowledge could sometimes literally, technologically, or sometimes more conceptually, become a kind of platform that we can actually take to the amphibious architecture project and like help us develop the exact SMS interface there. Or the living city project was also conceived as a platform that allows communication between different things, and that in a way kind of leads into the way that Living Light is communicating between the sensors and the actual building as a facade. So
you also do that between your own practice and your academic practice? And do you provide your students also of this material to work with it?
Yeah.
Literally?
Yeah.
And do you work the other way around? Do you ask them to produce instructions and manuals that you can use yourselves?
Yes, and also the students in the following semester, so they don't have to start on you, but they can take whatever is done before and develop it further.
Yeah, so we very specifically ask all current students to document their work in a way that others could use it to solve a similar problem in the future.
Mm-hmm. How much of that requires expertise? How much of the reading of that requires expertise?
Of that documentation?
Yeah.
Reading of the documentation? It requires more interest than expertise, because it's often as sophisticated as it gets in our classes or even our own work. It remains at a somewhat of a hobbyist level.
an amateur, a non-expert.
Mm-hmm. But potentially that's where it's most helpful to share, because the learning curve, you can affect the learning curve dramatically if you actually share the resources.
Yeah. Does the work get progressively complex? I mean, how would you scale the progression of the research as you go from one project to the next one? Would be a process of simplification, a process of complexification, a process of, you know, multiplicity of I don't know, media.
I mean, that's good. Another good question. I don't think necessarily the progression is toward more complexity, but it is kind of toward exploring new questions incrementally.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can start to take things for granted, so if project number one gives us some insight or technology or capability, then potentially project number 10 can use that without making that as much a point of the project.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore we can explore something else. So in some way it's kind of incremental and like aggregate, but not necessarily progressing toward more and more complexity.
I mean, I was asking because in a way as you develop the research, your projects, there is also the risk of constructing a field of expertise in itself.
Yeah.
That requires progressively higher skills or higher forms of expertise to understand it. In that sense, it runs the risk of closing itself to a circuit.
Yeah.
Of non-experts that are actually experts.
That's a great point. One way of looking at that is that we have said before to ourselves and others that we don't want to become the responsive facade guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does that make sense? Like while we're continuing to explore, and have been exploring for a few years now, responsive facades, we don't imagine that our vision for our own practice will involve us becoming deeper and deeper experts at that one thing. And that's why we often refer back to this kind of diagram or the process of research or exposing things like constructions, because that's not specific to interactive architecture or sensors. That could be true of anything. So I do think that that's one thing that will protect us against too much kind of specialization or expertise, if there's something to be protected against, is our own approach and interests. So I think there will be a time where we fade out of a certain body of research and other people who keep going with it, and we enter some new field where we're equally novices. And maybe that protects a little against, because I think it's a very good point that we don't want to create this whole world from scratch that at first glance is easy to access, but then requires so much specificity that it becomes closed again.
Yeah.
Mm. Have any advice for?
I appreciate your concern.
In general, I think in the beginning of a project, we try to learn as much about the technology as possible, like hands-on, first-hand. And then as the project develops more and more, I think slowly we involve more consultants or people who actually help us. Like once we've learned just enough to do our project and understand conceptually and technically and whatnot, then I think at a certain point we get a lot of help from other people to actually kind of help us realize it in the best way we imagine it to be.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I all this time I had in my mind this image of lowbrow architecture, lowbrow technology,
yeah,
related architecture. My the other side of the question would be then what makes you not just work directly without relation with highbrow mediums like architectural publications, architecture academia, that are clearly working at the highbrow level,
right.
So in that sense, there is sort of while there is a sort of commitment with the hands-on, there is also sort of a need to present it as a form of culture, not just as a form of direct practice.
Well, I think it's out of an optimism that those two can be. That I'm not sure our projects are always deliberately engaging this, but I personally believe that just like our own research shouldn't become a closed loop that's inaccessible, the field of architecture shouldn't become a closed loop that's inaccessible. And that just seems so obvious to me that it's almost not worth stating, but yet somehow there are a lot of obstacles to it. So in other words, the general public works in architecture all the time, and everyone has a lot of thoughts about architecture, maybe unlike synthetic biology, everyone does have an opinion about architecture, so why are we to be made by not involving the general public in a discussion. But as a whole, it seems like there's an unnecessary disconnect, and so probably our own work tries to be a little of both. I think that the world can be a both.
So going back to the comment you made, I don't know how much time you have.
We're at about an hour and 15 in.
This is a bit discontinuous, but to the comment of we don't want to be one more, what did you say? Responsive world?
Just the responsive side guys.
You don't want to be one responsive side guys.
Yeah.
So, can you briefly make a map of practices that are apparently associated to yours, but you want to argue they are different, and why?
Associated by, like, people associate us with something.
Not referring directly to
things,
but let's say to forms of practice that you believe are qualitatively different to yours, even if they share some of the, I don't know, experiences or technologies or, like, you don't want to be the responsive facade guy.
Right.
Which has a clear tradition for a number of years in contemporary architecture. I mean, you know better about this, you know? So maybe there are more specific kind of inconvenience you find in not getting confused with other forms of practice that look the same to yours, with yours.
Well, I mean, maybe one general way to describe it is to think about the consultant model. So, something that we've done a little bit of, and it's still interesting to us, would be for an architect of a huge project, say, the renovation of a 50-story office building in Manhattan. Which has some architect. That architect may come to us and want us to explore some kind of responsive environment in the lobby. We're interested in that project, but we wouldn't want to develop, more and more expertise in only that, so that we would, in the end, be known, be operating more as a consultant than
a luxury.
Yeah. In part because our interests are broader than that, maybe in part because we're just not maybe naturally as inclined to develop the efficiencies and the expertise that would be necessary for that. But also in part because one of the things we like about using responsive technologies or sensors or text messaging is the ability to think, now what should we do? And say if we were consultants, then the load would be more like, give me one of those you did before, but in my building. And we would naturally want to say, no, we already, you know, we explored that, but here's something that's been on our mind recently.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's pretty general. It's not naming any other firms, but that's a model. And I think that some say even architectural practices are very good at that and actually make a good career in it. We even admire some of that kind of work. But we would always tend to, you know, want to be able to ask our, you know, more broad questions or our questions.
Yeah, in that sense, it seems that there is a distinction between who is commissioning the work, basically. Like, if the work is being commissioned by some public domain or by some private or by an office that is hiring you to do a form of expertise for a certain service within larger architecture projects, or that you set commission in the sense of producing your own premises, basically, like the Living City project, which I guess is more like even you invented it rather than that existing to you. I know those are different forms of.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. When is the Living City from? When did you do that project?
We began that project in 2007.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's with that.
End of 2007. And that
what's the status of that project? What's the form it's taking or it's taking form?
That's a good question. So it started as a kind of research fellowship with the Van Allen Institute, and that was in, I guess, late 2007. And we kind of explored the initial questions and created the initial functionality. Then next, we did a new iteration of it that was kind of shared between two exhibits, one in San Francisco and one in New York, that were running simultaneously, and we were exchanging data between a building in New York, a building in San Francisco. We haven't installed a new version of that since then. That was in 2008. But in an interesting way, we have been exploring some of the same questions now with our students and using a project that we feel a very close affiliation to called Patch Bay, which is by an architect named Usman Haque. And it's spelled P-A-C-H-U-B-E. But it's pronounced Patch Bay. And the idea of this project, and it's a long-term project at Usman Haque, and we really admire it, and it's exploring some of the same things that we're exploring with Living City, is to make basically an open platform for the exchange of sensor data. So potentially between buildings, like we were exploring, but really almost between any two sensors by creating a kind of web database and interface. And so our Living City project is now feeling an affiliation with Patch Bay, which launched, I think, since we started our Living City. So we didn't know about it prior to Living City, but now we're quite aware of it. And we're now exploring the use of Patch Bay as a platform with our students and even with some of our own future potential work. So it's another.
We should just make a poster of it. Point to it with every question. But, you know, so although we haven't officially been developing a new iteration of Living City, in some ways, like what we're exploring with our students is very related to that, which is in essence a platform for communication between buildings, you know, for two buildings to talk to one another with whatever various, you know, technologies that requires. And so in that sense, we're still very interested in that question, like what is the, what are the possibilities here? How does that change our buildings and our cities?
Well, there are two things that I think the project is introducing, but there are many in respect to the others. One is, to my point of view, a form of utopian position, or a form of utopia, if you want, or at least it works at a larger scale. It's like a thought about cities and urban environments, and it goes beyond more subjective experiences and more what kinds of cities could happen. No? And the other is that it has a feedback loop. I mean, more like, while the other projects are more like expression projects, like they basically transfer information to another medium, this project seems to be doing that between two different mediums, or at least for many. No? That's why I was trying to ask about that project in relation to the rest of the project, in terms of if that project was before, after, parallel, it's something more recent, or how do you locate yourself in that difference?
Yeah, no, I think that's another good observation on your part. But what we were deliberately exploring in Living City, like Suen was describing, is more of the platform than the content. Mm-hmm. And in that way, I think that's a great observation, that the other projects were more of an interface, some of them more complex than others, but somewhat of a one-way interface. Mm-hmm. And we were interested, and so those happened earlier, and Living City is one of the latest ones we've done in that. Was saying, now that we have these potential very specific interfaces, you know, what's one way in which we can connect them? Or that just kind of naturally occurred to us as like, what do we want to explore in this next project?
Are you worried that they will get out of control?
The buildings?
Well, because in a way, in the other process, one could say, because they are one way.
Yeah.
In a way, you are trying to control. You are
filtering.
You are filtering, but to a certain extent, you are controlling that the effect looks like something and has a certain experience. In this one, you start to lose that control. I mean, you start working ecologically.
How about this? Are you worried that the internet might get out of control? I don't know if I've answered to your question whether it would get out of control or not, but in thinking about that project and while working on the project, we had a lot of thoughts about, so what is this like, or is there a precedent like this, or how do you understand it? And I thought internet was kind of an interesting parallel to what we're imagining, but it's for different audience and different kind of scale, I guess, in a way. But because the platform is it's open to people so that they can create anything on it, I think we don't know exactly what has happened or what problems could be there or what it would be actually good for, but I think the platform itself being open enough, I think, just opens up a very interesting kind of playground for a lot of people.
Just to make it more clear, actually, it's not that I worry about it getting out of control. It's more that I was asking if you are interested, or if you would worry. I mean, if you are interested in the out of control.
We agree with your
idea that it might get out of control, but we're not worried.
Mm-hmm.
We're excited.
Would you celebrate it then?
Yes.
You would.
I mean, in the most general sense, yes. We would want to. We're interested in what might happen.
Another interesting question that came out from the project was, like, who actually gets to control, you know, if it's about communication of data and expression of data and whatnot on the larger scale, who actually gets to control these? Like, how much do you have control over it? Is it from the government, or how much say do you have in the whole system? I think, again, we don't know the answer to it, but I think that was a very interesting question that everybody immediately kind of picked up when we presented the project and started talking about it, thinking about it.
How would you sell a project that may get out of control? How would you sell a project that may get out of control? I mean, like, it seems that there is a completely different public. Mm-hmm. Because in a way, one could argue that in their projects, you may be selling them by saying that it's providing a service, a form of service to someone or to... Well, this one, may not.
Well, another model is it could be considered an infrastructure or a utility. So I would, if I went to an owner of a new building, I might say, I realize, you know, since you're a very sophisticated property owner and you're commissioning a great building, you've probably already integrated a lot of sensors into your building. And they're performing all kinds of helpful things, like turning off the lights when people aren't in a room and monitoring carbon monoxide and protecting people's health. And I might say to them, imagine if your sensor data, or if basically you would have access to not only your own building's sensor data, but every other building in New York or a series of other people in that building's social network. And in return, you would offer your building sensor data to everyone else. I'd say, you know, wouldn't that be helpful? For example, would it help you to do something which has a benefit to the larger community and no detriment to your building, like saying, turn on the air conditioners in the summer at certain hours of non-peak demand of the city buildings. And say, you know, you could do that if you had data about other buildings' energy use, and all you would have to do is allow your building's energy use to be shared with others. So I think there's a kind of there still is a direct, potentially functional, and at least case study example for like why you might need this. Not that it's just adding a kind of unnecessary layer. And so while we're not super focused on one single implementation or one example of how it's going to be most useful, we are on the lookout for specifics. So we're not just interested in any future possibility. We're thinking like, how could this really be used? And in that way, it's a little out of control, but and it's unpredictable maybe, but it's also, it's not a... I guess it's not
Maybe at a bar next time.
Huh?
Maybe at a bar next time.
Yeah, we could.
I am curious to hear your thoughts, but yeah, just to summarize a little bit, because maybe you've been a little unclear or something about it, but there are other practices that are exploring interactive architecture and the close relationship with that. So, we closely follow their projects, we admire them a lot. We're interested in what they're doing very specifically and what direction they're going from one project to the next. And that's a sub-theme. It's not every architecture and innovation that goes with that, but that's a common thread, and it's not totally unique to us, but one thing that we're interested in that we share with some other firms. But maybe the more general thing, like to more specifically describe something that we already touched on a little bit, is the approach that, or the idea that an architect would be asked to be most generally a problem solver, but to look at a situation in a new way and come up with some proposed, basically a hypothesis for like, what if we did this, is something that I think is a general description of the way I understand all the firms in this issue and of our generation in general. That it's that to look at it in a different way. That the question would not be relevant to us, that sometimes get asked to me, and I'm sure gets asked to a lot of architects, what kind of architecture do you do? Like, that's not the question. Like, it seems absurd.
I think
that is shared among the other firms. They would all be like, they can equally design responsive facade, an urban plan, like, new mixed-use skyscraper and a piece of furniture. Again, like the Eames, to put it in a little bit of a historical perspective.
I think there's also, to a varying degree, of course, but a willingness to collaborate and share stuff with other people of the same generation so that the things they develop more becomes more interesting and more widely kind of potentially have a wider impact.
Yes, and so that ties back to something we talked about at the beginning, that we feel that the open source attitude is somewhat, as a spirit, shared between the other firms in this issue and between our generation.
And actually very optimistic and positive in general about you don't have to create a huge multi-million dollar solution to have an impact on certain issues, and I think there's a certain optimism that through the small practices that we are operating, we can still contribute and have an impact on larger issues. I think there's definitely that there.
Yeah, and as a collective with some shared insights and responsibilities and goals, then also have an impact. The projects add together to create something.
Can I ask you to maybe just? I mean, because the pairings were at least they were considered, and I will say amongst the editors that there was discussion that there was some kind of crossover and commonalities in your work actually. So if you could respond, maybe what you think those might have been or.
I was thinking that, of course, I could try to look at the specific points of connection between the work you do and the work I do, probably more genealogically than in the actual field of but I feel that maybe I would run the risk of being general, but I would prefer to say that the commonalities have to do with the problems that I feel our generation is getting into. And perhaps opportunities as well, but I'm more concerned about the problems, actually, myself. And for example, and in a way that some of these are also embedded in my questions, which were not particularly kind of trying to put you in a kind of uncomfortable situation, but I think there are questions that one should ask at this time, at this point in time.
Yeah.
And they have to do, for example, with the risk of homogenization of whatever it is that we are considering new, and then the fact that that we consider new falls into a form of convention, a new form of convention. Then the risk of sort of the work becoming or being read progressively, generation after generation, as technocratic or as slowly something. Then the question of the difference between the developing specificity in the work or the work becoming a new form of specialization, which is a new technical point. The more you develop a certain specificity, the more it requires a new form of expertise that then gets detached from everything else, from any common sense need of the practice. Then the question of power or capability. I mean, the way partly what you are saying about one defining its own terms as a practitioner in terms of the possibility to think things anew or afresh. To me, that's an interesting point in your practice, but it's also something that is shared by the last 15 years of practitioners.
Yeah.
And at the same time, because of the new forms of expertise, the system is closing itself again, and these new forms of power are becoming again sort of the instrument to something else, no? The instrument to a larger form of practice, conventional practice, that tries you to do the lobby, so, in a powerful way. So,
yeah. Yeah.
So it becomes a weakness again. So I mean, in a way, I would prefer to put myself in that level of sharing, no?
Yeah.
I think we share those problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting because I think all of those apply very specifically to our practice, and I think it's very interesting to me to hear you describe them that way. They ring true as concerns to me as well, but it's helpful to have dialogue with you, you know, about them. And it's actually interesting and in some ways heartening to hear that I think what you're saying is that those are problems common to not only us but to others in this issue. And
yeah,
it's a revelation to me. It's a shared thing, generation.
I don't know, I feel that, I mean, for a few years now, I've been feeling that these are increasingly important problems we are confronting. Beyond the specificity of what you do or what I do.
Yeah.
That in any case, we can't escape these problems that are growing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good place to end it.
Yeah.
But I want to ask one question off the record. It doesn't have to be part of the
question. But record it.
I'll keep on there. But the living, just the name, I'm surprised it didn't come up in the conversation.
I was going to.
I mean, there's so much discussion about kind of sensors and, you know, I'm just...
Why life?
Yeah, why life? Why living? Why? I recall, because I went to school with David and Tim, and they were just slightly ahead of me. And I remember discussion about the name.
Oh, me?
Yeah. Just a curiosity about why living. It seems,
well,
in a certain sense, so antithetical to building, you know, traditional kind of, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the way in which we would probably prefer to summarize it. That
we're interested in bringing architecture to life. But broadly speaking, that doesn't only mean the kind of thing that might be most obvious, but we're interested in some forms of kinetic architecture, but really bring it to life in multiple ways and multiple layers, and that's why living seemed like a good idea, at least at the time, that there's multiple ways you can imagine that. It might mean moving, it might mean growing, it might mean that there are human-like concerns, that there's a responsibility that it changes over time. Like, all of those possible ways to slice it seem well described and by the term, or at least some of them are suggested. And, but most generally, although there may be other things that were, you know, that we talked about at the time we made a name, the most general thing that I think we still try to integrate into a lot of projects and practice in general is bringing architecture to life.
From using like the most primitive material, like light, to all the way up to the like sensors and actuators that actually give life to space and everything in between.
And this too, I mean, like,
like, obviously we have
I'm like a one line answer, but I mean that it's this. It's like it's an ecosystem. It's not just a, it's not a, despite our description of one-off, it's not a standalone. Nothing can be considered alone. So I think that's summarized too. Like the thing changes over time. It's living implies it's related to other things. It shares resources with other things. Like, so we think that all of that discussion should apply to building and even an ecosystem of ideas, not just technologies or not just shared physical spaces. But
you know, I love the discussion. I mean, everything about the discussion. You know, that it's not about the goal. It's not the, you know, it's we have these issues that are being dealt with, and everybody is there's a kind of focus around those things. It's not a kind of outside teleology of you know of what's making things up. So in a way, like where the practice is going is a bit unknown. You know,
yeah. Interesting.
It was great.
Good.
That was really good.
Yeah, the questions.
Yeah, okay.